ladies and gentlemen, it's Casterbus. I'm Christian Corley. He's James McLean. We're back. And for the first time together in 2025, which might seem like I'm over-egging the portentousness of this, but actually I'm taking a few weeks to actually sort this out because, you know, it's the middle of February. And you'd think things were more underway by this time of the year, wouldn't you? You'd think we'd have managed to get our acts together. But no, apparently not. So,
I mean, I don't want to sound like, you know, an atypical podcast host or a meme, but, you know, didn't January went really slowly, didn't it? And now February seems to be going really fast, eh? Yeah. What's that all about?
Yeah, what is that all about? No, but seriously, though, it really did seem like a very, very long month. I'm not really sure what that was all. I think it was the weather. I think it was down to the weather. I'm not sure what it, but I mean, I can't say that that's the fact, you know, in warmer climes or whatever. But here in the UK, it was pretty much a case of grey, gloomy skies all the way through, really.
But I like that. I mean, I've always sort of vibed a little bit with that.
We can tell from your demeanour, James, but no, do carry on.
Catch 22, there's that line about wanting everything to be boring because the more boring things are, slower time goes, the longer that you'll live before you die. There's that sort of nihilistic notion. And somehow January fulfilled that for me. I felt like my life had been extended by at least 2 months. And while it was kind of gloomy and not a great time, I kind of valued that because time just does go so fast.
Well, actually, no, you're mentioning that whole thing and that taking an attitude to January. But when we last spoke, you were doing stuff to try and revive the nostalgia of Christmas or the feels of Christmas.
That was so long ago, I can't remember. But yeah, that sounds like me.
Yeah. Well, how did... So, can you remember how it turned out?
We recorded that, didn't we?
We did record that,
yes.
Yeah.
So I did, yes, I had my little advent calendar.
Yes.
Which I opened every day. I dare I say, thematically, religiously, I suppose, for the festivity, depending, I suppose, on how you tackle Christmas. I enjoyed it. I liked it. I feel next year, I think, as we said, I'd like to get, if it still exists at the time, a Radio Times.
Right.
And just mark with a highlighter what I am probably not going to watch over Christmas, but would like to if I was 12.
Yes.
And free of responsibilities and still had passion, love, caring and wants in my heart.
Okay, that little sound effect means that what you are next going to hear is the main body of the podcast, and you're missing around 18 minutes worth of discussion between James and myself. Why is that? Well, if you go over to our Patreon at patreon.com/Casterbus, you can hear all of that for free. You sign up for free, support us on Patreon, not with money, but with love. There is an option to pay should you wish to, and we're hoping to add some merchandise later on. Really, the podcasts are moving away from the current method of distribution and support that we have come to know and love over the years, and we're embracing the Patreon world in order to support our efforts moving forward. So, as I say, the full version of the podcast is only available on Patreon. That means it's also ad-free. You don't get any Spotify adverts. You get it a few days earlier. For example, this podcast was released at the weekend rather than midweek. And you get it with additional material. You just go to Patreon, sign up, free account, you get the podcasts. Simple as that. Okay, now on with the rest of the podcast, which, you know, you've still got another 40 minutes, but it could have been an hour long if you'd been on Patreon. Right, a few things have happened in the world of Doctor Who over the past few months. I think we should probably kick off with the news of Tom Baker's award, because it's kind of been long overdue in the minds of many people, I think. And Tom Baker was given an award. Do you have it? See, what's happened is I've clicked the link in WhatsApp and it's opened the web browser in WhatsApp, which has never happened before.
I don't know. I just don't understand why we don't get any awards. So he's been awarded an MBE for services to television in King Charles III's 2025 New Honours List, as reported by the Doctor Who Companion and by Mr. Philip Bates.
Never heard of them. I'm sure they'll do very well, though.
Baker, of course, is best known for playing the Fourth Doctor between 1974 and 1980, appearing
yes.
in huge number of classic, much-loved serials, including The Ark in Space, yeah, it's all right, Genesis of the Daleks, Over Long, Terror of the Zygons, it's actually pretty bland when you watch it, Face of Evil, good production values, but actually quite a dull story, Robots of Death, excellent, brilliant, can't get enough of it, Pirate Planet, that's just...
I like
Gareth
it.
Cavanna personified. City of Death. Yeah, States of Decay and Agopolis. It's fascinating just to see which ones Phillips decided to...
Yes.
By the way, that any normal journalist would pick three, but a Doctor Who fan picks like having 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And frankly, it's about time. So he's become Sir Tom Baker.
No, he hasn't, but he... Should be, I think, is the point.
Then again, Sir Tom Baker sounds even better. I'm just reading what Phil's put. I don't know any of this. And CBs have gone to to Sarah Lancashire, Carrie Mulligan, Anne Reed, and Stephen Fry has been given a knighthood. So there we do have.
Yes, we do have a knighthood in there. Anne Reed was originally from Redcar.
Wow.
Yeah. She went to the school that, when I was like going to school age, primary school age, I had a choice of two schools, and she went to this school that I didn't go to. Obviously, about 30 years before me, whatever, but yeah. Fact.
Yeah. Again, it's like, why no awards? We provide relevant facts, which are topical to what we're talking about.
There's a surprising
We're ongoing. We've been going for a long time. Have I mentioned that? Yeah.
Well. Yes, you have mentioned that. Yeah. We should. I've also been contacted about the idea of us doing a trailer.
A trailer for what?
Our podcast. Apparently, you have to do trailers for podcasts these days.
Yeah, I've seen some of that. I have been listening to podcasts, obviously not our own, because that'd be crazy. but yeah, I've
we're
been
double the listenership.
We double the interest. Yeah. That suggests, please don't say that you listen to our podcast, because that would be a very damning response to our listenership.
I do listen to our podcast.
So you are the listener. So to double it would mean it's just us two would be potentially listening to it at best, but currently it's just one of us.
Well, you bring that up. So what I should probably do at this point is refer to our Patreon, which has been growing, and we've got more members of our Patreon, which is free to join, and you get the podcast early and ad free. You don't get any of those Spotify ads on it as well. You also get, usually, unless I'm hosting solo, but if it's me and James talking, then you probably get extra content as well. So it is a benefit to join the Patreon, which is free. I keep saying it's free because it's free. There is the option to pay if you wanted to, and you can get a couple of trinkets and what have you, but the podcast itself is free via Patreon and early and ad free. And with extra content. See, that's a thing that happens in a lot of podcasts these days, that actual phrase. And I felt a little bit dirty when I said it the first time. Actually, probably the fifth time as well. But in our quest to get some sort of award, I'm just throwing it in there now. It's got to happen. You know, one way we could get an award is to actually host our own awards.
Yeah, I'm up for that. I mean, there's a part of me which was like, no, why would we do that? That would be sad. Well, sad is an emotion. I don't tend to have much emotion, so therefore it's not going to have an impact on my decision. I think why not? The world is sort of run at the moment by awards and value through engagement, you know, content farming. And it's like, I don't know, 15 years, maybe we should have an award for something. Or maybe, just maybe, there's a reason we don't have an award after 15 years, and that's because we're not very good. Stunned silence at the other end of that.
Well, I was going to say, your thoughts on that, please, to podcasterbers@gmail.com, which is another thing that podcasts do, I've noticed. They give their email address out so people can get in touch. And we've never done that.
I love the way, again, even in this conversation, we're talking about the podcast as a noun, as something separate to what we do. This is what podcasts do. Maybe we could learn from what podcasts do as a podcast.
Yes. So anyway, Doctor Who. Now, there was another reason to report on Doctor Who, and that is the Doctor Who In Memoriam movie compilation compiled by Toby Haydock in late 2024, which compiled clips of all of those from the worlds of Doctor who sadly left our world in 2024. Added to that is writer David A. McKinty also passed away in December. So there's, I pay your respects to the people who have passed away via the video. McKinty is not included in there. He also wrote Star Trek books as well as Doctor Who books. Yeah, he's quite an accomplished writer in the world of spin-off media. So it's, I think I was at a convention with him once, one of Gareth's events. I think he was speaking at. I don't think I saw his talk though, but he was involved back with the New Adventures, the Virgin New Adventures back in 93 with White Darkness. That was his first one.
Yeah. I mean, I used to it's a terrible thing to say. I used to really dislike his work.
Oh, right.
And then there came a point where I actually started to enjoy it. I think there was just a style of his writing which took me a while to get used to, and I can't explain what it is, because it wasn't like there was like it was convoluted or highly descriptive, but there was just a way that he wrote narrative which I think that was the first one I read of his, and I found it hard. And then I read a couple of others, and I actually found eventually, I think, do you see what I mean? I think sometimes you do have to. Someone doesn't naturally connect with you in their writing, and there's nothing wrong with it. And then eventually, sometimes you click with it. And
was there? And this is just me speculating and recalling, because I've read a lot of classic Virgin New Adventures and BBC books. Was there a pulpy element to his writing?
Yeah, I think there possibly was, and maybe some of it was topic. Maybe the sort of things he wrote about just. And how he wrote them just didn't, as I say, just didn't work for me initially. And then, or maybe I just matured, because, I mean, you know, still quite young back then.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But it is funny, because he was kind of one of, as you say, one of the sort of like fresh bloods of Doctor Who, that's, you know, with the new adventures encouraged and brought in.
Mm.
And he wrote quite a few, as I recall. I'm just having a look. Yeah, White Darkness. Yeah, I struggled with it. I mean, it was, and again, I think I reread, I think I struggled and gave up, and then I reread it and then found my interest in it, because it was Haiti, wasn't it? Yeah. In the First World War, which I suppose as a young reader wasn't an area which kind of initially connected, but I think it was the way he wrote. But yeah, eventually his stuff did connect with me, and I really liked his work. And I think, again, as I say, he was such a cornerstone, one of those cornerstones of where Doctor Who would go from the end of the TV series.
Mm.
It's kind of scary when those sort of people are going now. You know, you always think, oh, the people are going, the people from the 70s, understandably, and we get that, and that's a shame. But our era is untouched and will be largely untouched. It's like, well, no, that's not the way it goes. Time moves forward. January aside.
Yes. Rest in peace, David A. McKinty. Something else of significance has occurred in the world of Doctor Who over the past few months, and that is the increasing reliance isn't the correct word here, the increasing demonstration of the restoration of missing episodes using artificial intelligence, generative AI. This is something that has occurred quite widely among fan community for different purposes. For example, I shared with James earlier something called a Twitter account called DW Doctor Who and the Computer Pictures, or at DW_Midjourney, where someone had illustrated a scene from Mark Platt's Spare Parts, in which some Mondasian Cybermen, as we've been calling them since 2017, walk up a street. But that's not the only thing that's going on with that, because a gentleman called Ian Levine, who you've probably heard of, has also been working with people to establish restored episodes of missing Doctor Who using AI. And the results are mixed, I think, is in fairness, James?
Yeah, I'd say they're mixed.
Yes, yeah, so some of them look really good. Others look, they have that the whole, you know, uncanniness about them. I'm intrigued to know what you... Because we've talked about this before, recording the podcast and everything. And we will move on to the whole the power element of it, and nuclear power, etc., that we referred to earlier. But just, what do you think of these examples from Levine?
I don't know. I'm not interested at all. I think part of it is a detachment from AI in a sort of creative sense. That I think even when people are sort of experimenting with, I don't know, even like still montages or trying to recreate episodes or even trying to half animate those, or there's a certain sense of sort of creative input and satisfaction as a watcher of seeing something which you know has had so much more intrinsic person involvement, if you see what I mean. And I know that's an old argument against AI, and I'm not really trying to sort of drudge up these sort of boring debates, but I find personally, as soon as I kind of know how it's done, and I suppose in a similar way to how people have had issues with CG to some degree, even though we've got to acknowledge, you know, CG, there's a lot of great artists behind a lot of generated images, especially in the last third, even going back to some of the more what we'd now consider ropey ones. I suppose there is always that kind of detachment from it when you know that it's really just... I don't know. I suppose in a weird way, Doctor Who, to me, part of its meaning and interest is not simply an aesthetical thing. It's tied into the thought of a show which is so bizarrely craft, interwoven, the sort of multiple levels to it, which are all involved around creativity, whether it's the writing, the production, and even the creativity of fans and the way that we talk about it and we try and build and rethink, like we're doing in this non-award winning podcast, where we try and rethink and understand it in different ways. That's so much stuff which AI content just doesn't connect to in any way at all. There's nothing it delivers there in an image that a conversation on that wouldn't deliver, if you see what I mean. It doesn't really realize anything for me. And we've had enough content around to sort of see what these things would be like without resorting to that sort of very, very detached means of response or visual response. So, yeah, I don't mean it in a way to sort of be rude or to dismiss people's projects and passions. And I fully welcome everyone to sort of explore Doctor Who in the way that has meaning for them. And if that's what brings their meaning, I respect that. But for me personally, I think that's why I feel detached from it. It's not a snobbish thing against AI, although, as we've talked about before, maybe here, but certainly offline, there are issues and concerns I have with AI on various levels, but I think that's what gets it to me. I see an image like that and I go, well, so what?
Yeah.
You know, I could imagine that. And there's nothing that's gone into that. There's no depth to it that I could admire. No skill sets. It's not even like a positioning of people in costumes. It's just scraped and artificially constructed. I don't know. It just doesn't do anything.
There's an interesting argument that the BBC's approach to missing episode animations has perhaps encouraged Levine to take this route.
Yeah, and I get that. But I think it's a meaningless pursuit in a weird... Well, no, it's a pursuit which has the intent of meaning but won't deliver the meaning that it's after. Because I think the issues with the animations, and I get that, is that it is, well, let's say beyond uncanny, really, because you constantly are aware that this is never going to actually recreate what it's trying to recreate, no matter what your opinions are on the art styles. And I have no issue with the art styles. I find them quite interesting to watch, and it's kind of cool. But I get the fact that if you're looking to sort of really feel what you'd have felt if you saw the full intended production, they're a long way from actually giving you that, and in some ways take away from it potentially. But I don't think these approaches will ever do that, because you will still feel they're uncanny. And even if you made it absolutely perfect, I think there would still be a feeling of like, could you ever sort of detach yourself from that? It's like when you play a video game, isn't it? You can play a video game. You're always in that two minds that you're kind of half involved in the story. Say it's something, a sandbox game like Cyberpunk or Red Dead Redemption or whatever. You're involved in that story, but you're also very much aware of its construct, that it's not the Wild West. It's simulating the Wild West. In the same way, I've been rewatching again some of Westworld, the TV series. And they have that very clever thing of people go to that park to be immersed in the West, but the people who go can never detach themselves from the fact that they view the hosts and the robots in there as not being real.
Right, yeah.
And it's like, oh, I don't want to do this quest. Don't. He's wasting my time. He's only going to come over and if you go and touch him, he's just going to trigger a quest. Or, you know, they can do horrific things to these robots because they know they're not real, which allows them to abuse them in vast many ways to their own satisfaction, which to some degree one does in video games with NPCs, or can do. I find it very difficult in Cyberpunk. I'm desperately trying never to run over anyone. I don't go near the police. And if I find a rival gang and they're just hanging out, just chatting, I'm not going to touch them. They're not doing anything wrong. Not a problem. You know, that's how I roll. I'm the nice hitman. But yeah, I think that is the problem ultimately, is that no matter how you do with AI, you'll always be seeing it for what it is and never for what it's meant to be. Mm. It'll never be the original. You'll never get that. And you'll always be partially suspicious of that. You'll never be able to see that as truly being Patrick Troughton tackling a Yeti. You'll always see it as an AI-generated Patrick Troughton, a representation of that attacking the Yeti. You can't get there. It's gone. And I think to a horrible way, you've just got to accept that to some degree.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I would largely go along with that, I think. The other thing about this is that I think Ian Levine is maybe concerned that, and I don't know why, but he's maybe concerned that maybe his initial contribution to Doctor Who's missing episodes might be overlooked in favour of someone who came more subsequently into the area and wants to kind of reaffirm his, shall we say, importance to the matter of lost episodes being rediscovered or rescuing old Doctor Who episodes. Do you think that's fair?
It sounds a very human characteristic, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And in the end, I think one has to remember that we're all of a moment, and then we are all ultimately, we die, we disappear. Our memories, the memory of us becomes a caricature of what actually happened. You know, everything becomes more reduced as time goes on. You just got to accept that. And yeah, his actions many years ago had a significant impact on retaining some, you know, greatly important historical artifacts to the franchise and the people who love it, and to TV history. And no one should ever want to take that away from me. And that's a great thing that's happened. But yeah, eventually, yeah, it's going to disappear. People, as a person, it's going to become less relevant. So yeah, I'd argue, just move on from the fact you did a great thing. And I'm sure that sort of insular history of the show, that will always be recorded. But you don't have to sort of try and maintain your relevance. I think that's always a mistake. What is to be relevant? Why does it matter in the end, you know? It's a pointless pursuit, I think. Sigh.
The other significant aspect to this, of course, is that it's relying on regenerative, or beg your pardon, there's a Doctor Who pun for you, or Freudian slip or whatever, generative AI, artificial intelligence based on large language models that assimilate lots and lots of data and then interpret them based on queries and complex statements, etc., etc., etc. As James mentioned, there's not a lot of artistic... I mean, James didn't actually say this, but it's fair to say there isn't an awful lot of artistic merit to using generative AI to create art. There's also, however, what there is a lot of is power, energy, electricity, running big servers, server farms, because, you know, everything's, I mean, this podcast, the website, your cloud drives, your Dropboxes, your Google Drives, whatever, they're all sitting in server farms around the world. And these all require vast amounts of power, electricity, to run. And as AI is more widely used, let's just remember that Microsoft incorporates its Copilot AI into its browser. And what else have we got? We've got you've got Microsoft again with Azure. Most of the Microsoft's cloud services are relying on AI in some way. You've got cybersecurity solutions that rely on AI. Everything has an AI element to it, and AI has a large power draw. And this is... You mentioned to me earlier, didn't you, that a lot of the people involved in using generative AI and people that are appreciating its use, they're probably the same people who are greatly concerned over climate change and ecology, and that we're not doing enough to look after things, really, and be more efficient.
Yeah, I feel that. I think there's obviously areas where AI can be very useful, and you could argue that, I mean, there's a lot of wasted power across the world, so I think there's always a danger of just sort of saying that if there was no AI, things would be better. But when you see the sort of energy requirements of, as you say, some of those big data powerhouses like Google, certainly last year, and the up in its power usage, I think stateside was ginormous when it was, as it sort of integrated more AI into its software, into its applications. I think you've got to sort of say, you know, there should at least be, I think, an awareness from users, which I don't think is there. And I think that's a lot because it's not reported on.
Yeah.
It's not because users are. And so I think a lot of people who are using prompts, because I think there's a line, and I've never checked it out scientifically. So this is just obviously from what I've seen out there. It's something like they say a prompt use is equivalent to using a bottle of water.
Okay.
And we obviously use water as a unit because it's the amount of water used to keep these massive server farms cool, which is part of the concern around AI and the impact it has on the environment. And it just feels funny when you've got shows which it feels, again, to use that word, it's very antithetical to what Doctor Who's often about. I mean, if you could see a Pertwee story being about the misuse of AI, the consumption, you know, it almost sits around sort of almost like the Inferno rationale or of a sort of mindless desire to sort of push science forward without really checking the checks and balances required to make sure that it's not a disastrous move.
Yeah.
And I think AI, I think as soon as, you know, the tech market open sourced, you know, and there was provided open access, should I say, not open source, open access to these sort of systems, that there's just no space for the checks and balances to come back in, to come in and sort of go, right, do we need to think about this? If we've got concerns in the UK over, certainly in the UK over power, a few months ago, there was again concerns over power and you know, the questions of whether there might be sort of timed power usages and like. Power is an issue which drives political and international actions, and yet we're sitting here and we're just using large amounts of power to create silly images, to circumnavigate using the right creative people in jobs. We're not using it in the way that it could be used, where, I mean, you could even argue in terms of production, if you were to use AI to sort of reduce this reduce the costs on the labor of people rather than actually removing people and their labor for the use of AI. So, for instance, as we know, like the the FX market is massively overburdened in terms of workload and what they're expected to do and the amount of time they have to do it. And quite often ropey FX is down to the fact they just haven't had the time to do what they really should be doing. If AIs were there to help sort of manage that sort of expectation and not lose those people their jobs, that to me seems sensible. Certainly in bureaucratic and in administrative structures, certainly in our country with the NHS and the like, if AI can help support some of that crippling, you know, burden of workload,
yeah,
which great. But when it's kind of just being used to prompt up images and to automate creativity, which has no meaning or benefit, you know, and it circumnavigates the need, because the reason no one has done a proper replication or reimagination of some of these Doctor Who stuff is not just IP, it's just the work power, the skill, the craft, the money to hire to do it is too big. And you think, well, that's because we are a society.
Yeah.
And, you know, we should be, you know, it comes a point, and I know one of the arguments of this is like, well, it didn't stop the Industrial Revolution. You think, well, does that mean that's the right answer? Does there come a point where we want to make sure that we have meaningful lives and that we have creativity and that we can enjoy that and we're not sort of damaging our environment through it? I don't know. Yeah, as we say, there's just so many issues around this. And then when I see it, kind of frivolously used like this, I feel like for Doctor Who purposes, I feel that's just not very Doctor Who. It doesn't feel the spirit of Doctor Who. We should be trying to avoid using this where we can, and only using it for where it's needed. But what do we know?
Well, I mean, we haven't even won an award, so.
Well, exactly. Surely only award-winning podcasts should be making messages like this. And I don't, again, I've got to say, I know I'm not an AI expert. I'm careful about sort of talking on subjects I don't have the right amount of knowledge, but just on the basic knowledge I understand, I think these questions should be in the community ecosphere that we talk about and are talked about by experts and people within the power to make changes.
Mm.
And those decisions be made by those people who do have the knowledge. That's all I think I'm asking, is that we perhaps have a more open debate on how we deploy this. And I know that's going to be difficult when it's a global access thing. Again, yes.
I mean, it is a sense of a ship that has sailed, unfortunately. And, you know, a genie that will not go back into the lamp, a box of Pandora's magic that has escaped and will never be packaged up again, power left.
Well, this is it. There's no power yet, or it gets paywalled. I mean, at the moment, there's a lot of tech venture capital, which is invested in the AI market, which is allowing it to do what it does. Similarly, like in the early 2000s, websites, you know, everyone could have a website because it was the same sort of investment. And then it comes to a point where it was just no longer viable. And suddenly it was paywalled and you had to pay to have a website. It wasn't much, but you still had to pay. Maybe that will sort of happen with AI to a degree. I mean, obviously there are new sort of AI approaches which are limiting the amount of resources, which might also be a good thing. And maybe there will be a cultural distaste to it, which will start to come, that will make it, you know, where it's visible or is clearly exploitative,
I think
people will shy away from that product.
Yeah, I think it's very... the obvious comparison there is obviously with CGI materials. And I think that there's always been giveaways with artificial intelligent created video and images. And for start off, the number of fingers and limbs that some people had early on, that was a bit of an issue. But I think there's maybe probably, I mean, looking at the Cybermen thing, it doesn't look particularly natural. It's too shiny. It doesn't feel like it was created, you know, in any realistic scenario, other than digitally. So there's probably always going to be that kind of thing hanging over.
But have you seen the debate around the Fantastic Four poster?
No, I haven't. I've seen the trailer, but I haven't seen this. Yeah, no.
With the trailer, obviously they released a poster, a promotional image. And there's been a lot of conversation about whether that's been AI'd. And,
oh, yes, I did, yes.
And the response from Disney has been it hasn't been. But there's a lot of people going, well, there's a lot of duplicate characters which appear,
yeah,
and some of the hands look a bit odd. And then some people have been speculating about whether that's an intentional way to spark discourse around Fantastic Four, that they've deliberately done something which has either been hand-painted to be, or certainly created by a person to look slightly AI-ish to spark this, or whether it is AI'd and deliberately done to spark this, and whether the whole topic is being used to promote conversation around the film, which again is a sort of kind of scary way that it kind of normalizes the concerns, that it becomes, you know, that they don't feel that there's any risk in it being that this conversation could turn to people against the film, that there's not that worry about AI. And it's funny when you think that 20 years ago, the worry about AI was the Skynet model.
Yeah.
And I think while there's always going to be worries about the implementation of any automated process with anything which could have military output, I guess, I think, you know, our concern at the moment is, again, is one is, say, we need to be talking about the energy consumption. But yeah, I think we do still need to be making sure that we, you know, that sort of, this sort of Overton box on the conversation around AI doesn't just kind of make companies, you know, creating stuff with AI and not using people. Because, I mean, CG, yes, it did take away from a lot of practical approaches, but it still required skills.
Yeah.
You know, while AI is an automated system, it doesn't require, or certainly at the moment, it doesn't have that sort of... doesn't really have that same sort of tackle. And yet, as we know, it's going into all the Adobe products as well. So
yeah.
It is to some degree part of that process, and we've got to accept that. And I think that's fine, as long as we can acknowledge, or we are aware of the questions of what sort of energy that's using and whether we need it. When we get adverts and it sort of says, I saw an advert the other day on TV, and it was like someone having to say into the mobile phone, find me the best restaurant in the area. And you just feel like that voice should come back and just say, fucking hell, do it yourself, mate. You know, it's easy enough. I mean, that middle ground between interface and the person having to do stuff and computer technology, often still using AI architecture to actually help you find that stuff and bring up some spots. It's not that hard, mate. You could do that. We don't need that level of help. It's infantilizing, really, in a lot of ways, but we don't talk about it as being infantilizing.
I mean, I'm feeling a little bit guilty now because I've done that myself on a few occasions. I was particularly peckish one Sunday afternoon on the way to... just went out for a drive with the family, and we were edging towards Thirsk, and I always have my phone connected to the car. So I requested information about a nearby place to eat, and we were just passing a small village, the name of which escapes me at the moment, and there was a pub there that did pub lunches, Carvery, not even Carvery, just like freshly, you know, roasted thing. It wasn't like a buffet type Carvery, it was like they bring it out. And we thought, we'll try that. And it turned out to be really, really good, and we'd actually stumbled across an absolutely fantastic little... eatery, and I used that in that way to do that. So now I'm feeling like I'm being berated.
Yeah, I know we've got to be careful about that, because as we said, the AI architecture has been there within our applications for a long time before it sort of became the ChatGPT prompts.
Yeah,
sort of brought it to the foreground. Mm-hmm. So I think there's always a danger of making this into a very simplistic monster problem. Rather than acknowledging that it's far more complex than that. And the debate is far more complex than that as well. But I think it's just about us having that debate. And if I can be proved wrong and not to worry, and that there's an example that people aren't losing their jobs and unfairly for the benefit of managers, you know, just saving a buck, then I'm happy to be stand corrected. But I do kind of feel that it's going, as we said, without checks and balances. And it's taking people out of work, which the skilled people out of work, and it's not replacing them with other skilled people, which is kind of what you see in most industrial changes. It's just taking that job away, full stop.
Yeah.
And I think that's the danger. And I think also it's a danger to our market that if for whatever reason AIs or that sort of approach can no longer generate that material, you need to have people skilled to be able to do that. And we you can say that with society with before AI, with Adobe Photoshop and the like, you can see that as being a risk. We've talked about this before, how you can see logos designed in the 70s in terms of design and craft are often far better than those that should have been done sometimes in the 90s by designers who perhaps aren't so familiar with the nuances of design because they've not needed to be, because they are just buying font packages, putting it, you know, placing them, and they're not, then that sort of basic core skill is kind of lost because it's now done by a computer. And so that's always a risk, and it always has been a risk. So again, that's not a solely AI issue, but I kind of feel like, yeah, we still need to make sure that we've got people who can do these tasks in case you can't rely on the AI to do them.
That brings us to the end of this week's podcast. We would really love to know what you think about generative AI and its place in everything around us at the moment, but particularly for recreating lost episodes of Doctor Who. Drop us a line, podcastdervis@gmail.com. Reply to this posting on the Patreon or let us know through our Facebook page. We'll be back next week with a new show. Until then, it's goodbye.